I'm here in Swanling Bar, and I'm talking to Gregory McGovern. Gregory, you're from this village, and were you born and bred here?
Born and bred here, yeah. Born on the 23rd of June, 1958.
And were you?
My parents were shopkeepers on Furness Land on the southern side of the bridge, beside now the Methodist Church, and across the road from the local football field.
And what was your father doing for a living?
My father was a grocer.
Oh, yes.
And later on in life, then, we got the post office in 1977. So, and he was a small farmer as well.
And having the post office there and the business there, did you fall into that then?
Well, I went off, first of all, I went away to do a course in milling and grinding, and I was hoping to become an apprentice, maybe to go to the local factory, and I was sort of veering towards that, and then the post office became vacant, and Daddy applied for it, and he asked me that, would I be interested in coming home and doing that, and sure, at the time I said yeah, and I came home and worked it, and at that time the post office was a 24-hour service, in that there was no dial-in facilities. It was a local plug-in, old-type telephone exchange.
Oh, yes, because, I mean, this would have been in the early 70s.
Early 70s, yeah. Well, late 70s, but yeah. It was there. Before that, it was in Woods, which was across the ridge, and then I came across. And even that time, the telephone exchange was only open until 10 o'clock locally, and then there was party lines, which the people had to, there could be five people on the party line, and one ring was your or ours, two ring was the next door neighbour, and three ring was the man down further down the road, and four rings was the next man. So I think it was, because we had only seven trunk lines, and the most people we could have on after 10 was 35 people. Oh, and yes. The doctors, the guards, the post office, and maybe the chemist or something like that would be getting priority, and then a few other people came on board and they got lines. But I can't remember what year, it could have been in the 80s that we went on the all-night service. That means that we had to provide the service 24/7. So myself and my mother and father worked it, and we had a local lad in working for us as well, and we provided the telephone 24/7.
Well, that's very interesting now, because you're right. If you look like the village here is almost surrounded on all sides by the border.
It's a horseshoe, really.
Yeah. And so for that reason, and being close proximity to the border, making phone calls, did cross-border phone calls at that time, were they checked? Were they censored?
Not that we were aware. You know, we were never said to us that anything was censored. The only difference was that they had a dial-in system across in Kinnaly, which is across the border, which is our part of our parish, just called the parish of Kinnaly. But in Northern Ireland, they had the dial-in system, while we had only the plug-in system here. And that was the only difference we knew of. On one particular occasion, but there was an incident at the Dorada in County Leitrim. Nicholas Mitchell, he was a BBC correspondent, and he came and he dialed from the local kiosk, Swanland Bar 13, that was the number of it was, I remember. He was looking to get through to the BBC for the 6 o'clock report, and he rang and he told me who he was, and I got on to the girls in Cavan, who I knew quite well, and we were looking to get as quick as we could, but because I had to ring Cavan had to ring Dublin had to ring London, and that would have taken two plugs in Swanland Bar, two plugs in Cavan, two plugs in Dublin, and maybe two plugs in London. He would have had to go through 8 different plugs, and if any of them were faulty, the line would have been cut off. So we had to rush. I explained to him what was going on, and he had to get the news, to make the 6 o'clock news with the information he had got from the RADA. So he, instead of waiting for us, because we were too slow because the system was delaying him, he dashed to Kinnaly and got the dial system there and rang from Kinnaly.
Imagine that. So it was as primitive at the time.
He was out now, and at that time I would have been, you know, fairly well known the girls, and they would have worked, you know, I told them what was happening, who it was for, and they were working extra hard to get it through, and yet he couldn't wait because he was on a time scale to get that message to the BBC News for 6 o'clock.
Okay, and at that particular time, from 1972 onwards, you had the troubles, and they were going on all the time. Single day, you have bombings and shootings.
Well, in Swanabar, we had I think it was seven or eight bombs as such. There was it could have been 70. I'm not absolutely sure. You can check this out. I know it was the cup final morning, and Leeds were playing in the cup final because I supported Leeds at the time. But there was a bomb at the bridge just below the town, and then there was a bomb at the Garda station. And both of them bombs were defused by the army. And then a few months, or maybe I can't exactly remember the date, there was another bomb then at the first and last pub, which exploded. And luckily enough, nobody was killed in it. And then the next bomb was up in the middle of the town outside the hardware store. And there was a creamery can in the middle of the road. And from what I can remember, Mrs. McGinn was counting the money at night, and she looked out and she seen nothing. And a few minutes later, she looked up and the creamery can was in the road, and she called her husband, Noel. And Noel went to the hall door, and as he opened the hall door, the bomb went off, and the blast of the glass and everything put him back on the stairs, which is at the hall door. And unfortunately, Noel got an eye injury and got cuts and everything like that. And thank God, like, while it was unfortunate for Noel, and that was the only real injury we had of all the bombs in the area. The next bomb then was at the Irish House, which was just further up the main street, and it exploded again at night. It could have been late autumn, winter. Can't remember the dates again, but they all happened very close together. And at that time, I remember a local itinerant boy who was staying with the local priest, the curate, walked up a few minutes before the bomb went off, and he seen nothing. And the bomb went off, and again it blasted in the middle of the town, and there was lots of damage done again locally to all the local houses and everything like that. The next bomb was on the 8th of December, again just exactly the year, in the Catholic church. And it was in the church, and it blew the roof and destroyed the church. And there was a new church built after that from that. And then the next bomb was at the local school, in Furnaceland, St Mary's National School. And it was on the wind, and it blew out all the windows and doors. And at that time, obviously, when the bombs were going on, we lived up the village. And at night, from our point of view, just you'd be all the time aware of anything stopping, cars, noise, particularly in bed. And I slept in the front room, and we hadn't double glazing at that time, and any noise, you were just alert, thinking there was going to be something. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that came to our house was a fella called Jerry Cayley. He was a haberdashery dealer, or he dealt in clocks, watches, everything that was like that. He used to call, he's Benedict Cayley's brother. He arrived one day at our house, and he came in, and he was selling stuff to Daddy in the shop, and Daddy bought whatever he bought of him that day. And he had known him for years, and they got on very well. And later on that night, when Daddy was closing up, he went outside, and here on the wall there was a box. And Daddy and him forgot about Kelly calling, and called the guards, and there was a bit of a panic, and the bomb disposal crowd had to come along because there was a ticking out of the box, and we were all evacuated. And anyway, whatever happened, it transpired that Jerry forgot to put a box of his stuff back in his van when he was there in the middle of the day, and nobody's seen it because it was put behind the wall or something, yeah, like that. And that's what it was. It was just clocks and watches that he had taken out the shore.
But all the time you were alert.
You were watching. Yeah, you were alert. And everybody locally was, yeah, alert, because they were just expecting where was the next one going to be.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And while everybody got on well locally and everything like that, and there was no really there was maybe shots at the border at Kesty's Cross a few times, and there was people killed down there, and maybe they took on the army out at Gortorl and all that, because the roads were closed, and the local people and businesses on numerous occasions, well, not alone them, there came people from Dublin to try to open the roads, and that was going on in the middle of it all. And the British Army came in across the border a few times with local farmers, and they came across them. You'd hear stories about different people meeting them in the southern side in the fields and things like that. So,
and so that the inconvenience of all of that, because you had roads coming in here, and those roads were closed.
They were closed, and farmers had to make round trips of up to 15, 20 miles to see their cattle. They could look at them across the river, but couldn't bring the transport or couldn't father them, so they'd have to come round, go down through Kinnaly, go through a checkpoint, which was manned sometimes by soldiers who were all right and came across, but then other times to be fellas, and they'd just keep you there for maybe an hour, 2 hours, and the paratroopers were there, and they were deemed to be, you know, terrible for holding up the traffic. And then the local football club played a number of games when our field was being done up across the border in Kinnaly, which was only a mile down the road, but we had to go around just the one road to it, and we had brought down teams, and we brought two or three teams down. And one particular occasion, a helicopter went across the field, and we were well beaten at half time, and whatever the helicopter done, we got back into the game, and we drew the game, because we must have scared the life out of the helicopter scared the life of the other team that came up from the other end of Cavan at the time.
Oh, I see.
You know,
so but that kind of constant air watch, you know, with the helicopter going over with the troops. A mile up the road, you say?
It wasn't even a mile. It was about from the custom post to the border, it was a quarter of a mile, which is the lower end of the town.
Yeah.
But a quarter of a mile. And then there was a full army checkpoint there, and you went in, and it was like an enclosed area. And when you went in there, the person who was waiting next was another 200 yards back up the road. And when you were enclosed there, nobody seen what was going on because they closed the door behind you. And anything could have happened. And people sometimes were petrified going in there, going down to the army. Because you'd hear stories, and whether they were right or whether they were wrong, when you were going down there, you were always into, will I be the next one brought in, or will something happen to me when I go in? And you'd be worried about that.
Did you learn to live with this? Or was this something that always remained in your mind, that, you know, this should not be happening, that this is... you know, just because a field is cut in half, you know, that one side is one country and the other side's another.
It was
country.
Part of your life. And while, you knew, you thought it shouldn't be happening, you learned to live with it, and you had to live with it. And you'd be all the time worried that something might happen, but you still went through your daily routine, and you didn't let it upset your daily routine. And before the roads were closed, Swanlambar was a thriving town, with 13 pubs, 3 or 4 grocery shops, 3 drapery shops, loads of a chemist shop. It was a thriving village, and 3/4 of our customers came from the hinterland across Northern Ireland, and they regarded Swanlambar as their town. Once the roads closed, that cut off that, and the village just deteriorated after that. Now, acceptably, there was 33 guards and a number of custodians in the town, and they were on border duty, and there was soldiers at the border, Irish soldiers on one side, and they were changed every so often, and they generated a wee bit of custom, but not a lot. Hinterland was cut off, and Swanlambar just was devastated, along with other border towns in the area. So our whole all the customers was coming in and doing all their shopping just were cut off.
Your own business in the town?
Oh yeah, we would have suffered. The post office helped us keep it going for years and years and years, but once the trouble started, you could see year after year your income deteriorated, and it was just out of my mother and father kept it going because they were keeping us at school and keeping my younger sisters at school, etc., etc., just to make a living. But we had nothing else at the time, you know, to keep it going.
And so, was there ever a threat or intimidation?
There was no intimidation in Swanlambar itself, but you felt intimidated sometimes when you were crossing the border at the checkpoint. You would feel intimidated. You felt that anything could happen. Maybe when you were going through, maybe somebody would launch something at the checkpoint, because there was shots fired at it, there was rockets fired at it, and rockets fired at Kinnaly Barracks, rockets fired at Kinnaly Barracks, and it damaged the church in Kinnaly at the time, which is the other side of the border, you know what I mean? So people on both sides of the border suffered the inconvenience of having to go through the checkpoint.
What about the fact that geographically, the way you were positioned here would be an ideal location for a hotbed for the IRA. Is that true?
No, obviously there was Republican supporters, the same as there was everywhere, but the Sonnenbar was no more Republican than any other town, you know what I mean? It might have got a name some places that it was, but no, Sonnenbar, you know, wouldn't have been any more Republican than any other border town around the area, and there was every party and none, you know what I mean, and they all had their supporters. The local Protestant population got on well with the local Catholic population, and the Church of Ireland had their sale of work every year, and the Catholics supported that and they supported us, and we got on well. The neighbours, farmers all helped each other out and everything like that. So locally there would have been no sort of conflict, you know.
Why was Swanenbarry then hit so hard with all the bombs?
We don't know really why it got all the bombs at the time. Maybe, you know, there was different reasons. Maybe they felt it was an easier target before the checkpoints came up. I don't know. Obviously, you'd have to talk to some of them boys who'd done it. Why did they take it out? I have no particular answer to why Swanenbarry was picked out more than anybody else. You know what I mean? So,
So how did the troubles affect you personally? What kind of scars did it leave?
Well, the time that the bomb started, as I said, you were all the time going to bed at night, and when the first bomb started at the lower end of the town and it started up, then you were thinking, it's coming next to us. And the method, once the Catholic Church was hit, the Methodist Church was next door to our house. And I was thinking, well, if the Catholic Church is hit, there might be a retaliation. And I'm not, there was nothing in my head why I should have thought that, but I just thought it, that now the Methodist Church will be hit, or the Church of Ireland, which was up behind us, will be hit. It's sort of because of all the stuff that's going on in the north with tit for tat, you think, well, if the Catholic Church is now maybe the IRA or something, it'll blow up the Methodist Church or something like that. And I had no evidence, nothing like that, but it was just from the tit for tat thing, the way things were going, the troubles were going in the north, I thought maybe the Methodist. So therefore, going to bed at night, you're just, as I said earlier, waiting for something to happen.
I see, yeah.
You know, so, and any noise, as I say, after 12 o'clock, you know, some nights, because we had a shop, we used to stay open late. My father was great at crack, and he used to have all the locals in and they'd be chatting and things like that. And my mother often had to knock the floor to get them to go out and leave, you know. And then he used to play Scrabble with a lot of other people, and I'm diversifying now, but they could maybe stay till early morning, and they often went down. I remember a gentleman went down, he used to go down to the checkpoint, and the guard to be on duty, and I don't want to offend any guard, but sometimes the guard would be asleep in the checkpoint along with the soldier in the southern side, you know. But now most of them they were all right, but one or two nights he could relate where he was going down after playing Scrabble in our house, where the guard was asleep on the chair sitting there, just, you know, on his head down like that, which is only natural, you know what I mean. And I mean, nobody else maybe gone by for an hour before that.
It's unbelievable the way life went on. But have you got any idea as to how people, as you say, were the village, it upset the village, the business went down in the village. Have you got any memory of the phone ringing and some family where you were putting a call through and some family were after suffering some kind of trauma from the troubles?
No, not really. No, as I said, the one that I remember was the Nicholas Mitchell one, the time of that the Radio incident, him trying to get the BBC. There would have been other calls possibly in relation.
The one about what exactly happened that the BBC reporter was trying to.
There was an incident at the Radio Wood where there was a hijacking, and there was a soldier and guard killed. I think I can't remember just exactly now.
This was carrying
they had kidnapped. Was it some industrialist or something like that, and they had him hid at the Radio Wood, and the guards and army discovered what they had him hid, and there was an incident. So obviously it was news incident, and Nicholas Mitchell was the Northern Ireland correspondent at the time.
I think Nicholas Mitchell,
I think his name is. Mitchell. He's a BBC correspondent.
Yeah.
I think he's actually, or he was recently, the Royal correspondent on the BBC. But anyway, he came that evening, as I say, trying to get through to the BBC, and as I said to you, we were trying to get him contacted, and we couldn't get him contacted, so we had to go down across the border and use the dialing system they had there.
Yeah. And did people go across to make phone calls at the other side?
Yeah.
Because it was cheaper.
Well, of course, and sometimes they went down because it was easier to dial, you know, the number on the kiosk down across the border, which was only maybe a mile at Kesty's Cross. There was a kiosk there. And if they were ringing relatives in England or further afield, they could dial them rather than waiting for us. And, you know, as I say, you'd be using the cables, and you could get a bad cable, and your line, the call was, you know, noisy or rattly or something like that. Now, most of the time, the calls were fine and they were grand. But if you were making an international call, and it was quite expensive, people wanted to get a good line, so they probably went down. You know, not a lot of people, but some people did, and went down across the border and dialed from Kesty's Cross.
I see. And did you find that, you know, kind of that people were... because in the south of Ireland, and it probably affected you too here, that there was, with Section 31 ban on the Broadcasting Act, there wasn't coverage of what really was happening, and voices were dubbed over.
And it would have been, you know, obviously there was...
But you could tune into BBC.
BBC. We had BBC Northern Ireland, BBC London, the whole lot, and we had UTV and ITV, and we could see everything that was happening, and everything, any trouble was in the north, it was immediately, you know, BBC 5 Live. Myself, the time that they opened the roads, I was interviewed on BBC Radio 5 Live. The evening before the roads were being reopened, and so
was that like a whole new release of life? What feeling went through your mind
We thought that Swanland Bar would be rejuvenated, that the whole hinterland that had come in previously would still come back to Swanland Bar and would become alive again, and it did come for a wee while. But unfortunately, because it was over a 20-year period or a wee bit longer that the roads had been closed, that generation of people who had originally come to Swanland Bar and used it as a hometown had moved on. And the new generation who never came to Swanland Bar didn't really come to Swanland Bar. They had moved to Inniskillen, to other towns, and suddenly Swanland Bar was no longer their hometown. And the people who used it in the beginning came back for a while, but had got used to the alternative and only use Swanland Bar now and then, and went away from it again.
Imagine, it was closed for 20 years.
It was over 20 years that the roads were closed. There was the concession roads, they called them, and there was only the one road where you went over at Mullen and you had to go through the army checkpoint. There was a customs post. There was a Garda army checkpoint in Swanland Bar, which was really no problem. There was a custom post, and again, unless you were declaring some goods, there was no problem. It was just going through the army checkpoint Mullen that caused the difficulty for the local people.
I see. And but that can you remember that being interviewed? What exactly did you say?
Oh, look, at the time, because I was running the post office in the shop at the time, I thought it was, you know, I was hoping that it would go back to the times when I was a bit younger, when there'd be people coming across and doing their shopping. I remember my father had the local butcher shop was across from him, and on a Saturday afternoon, the two of them, Jack Keenan and Daddy, was Tommy McGovern, they were running off their feet with people coming in, and the local drapery shop, Gallagher's, I think, cigarettes. This is one of the biggest towns for selling Gallagher's cigarettes, because they used to come and buy cartons from across the border, you know, because it was cheaper, obviously, at the time. And it was a great time, and all the shops were doing well, and every shop in town reared their family and put them through school and everything like that. And you can imagine, like, the population is probably... has decreased a lot, all right, but it wasn't much more than maybe about 400 or 500. There's only about 200 now, but everybody were able to run their business. As I said, there was 13 pubs, there was 4 or 5 grocery shops, there was 1 or 2 cafes, there was the chemist shop, there was the second hand shops, there was everything like that, and they were all doing a good business. And on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday night, you couldn't park in the main street.
Okay, and if you were, what direction would you be going if you were coming through here?
This is the main route from Galway to Belfast, really. You know what I mean? A lot of people coming from the west went through Swanlambar heading north.
I see.
Yeah, and then there used to be Mullen Market, a big market, say, you know, a marketplace in the Sunday, and that was thriving at the time. And it kind of deteriorated once the checkpoint came as well. It kind of cut it back a wee bit because people going down to the to Mullen, which was only less than 500 yards below the checkpoint, people were getting fed up of being stopped at the border and being just harassed, really. Now, not all the time, but they were harassed. And once somebody got harassed, then the story went around, it was more harassed them.
Okay, now we're here in the in
Trivia House.
In Trivia House, and this was kind of, this was built, but and is now being used as a use.
As a community house. Trivia House was a shop, and our house, which is next door to Trivia House, was the offices of the old iron mills back at the turn of the century of the 1900s. And the Methodist Church, which is next door to us, it is said that Wesley spoke in it. And I have bought that since, and it's now a listed building, and really I've been refused planning permission on numerous occasions to do something in it. So I've left it as it is at the moment. I put a new roof on it, and hopefully maybe down the line we'll do something with it, make it into just a private residence or something like that. I can't touch the exterior of it. But
how important is it to have at this stage in your village a club, the GAA, and all these facilities?
The GAA is the mainstay or the main organisation in the community. Now, Swanlambar Development Association, who own this building here, are very good as well. There's the Triathlon Club, which has recently opened a number of years ago. Like, Swanlambar as a community are the envy of other local communities in that we have a lot of stuff going on. We have a musical society, the GAA, there's the Swanlambar Ramblers, the Walking Club, there's the Development Association. We have a number of festivals throughout the year. The GAA Club have their festival in spring. Now, they hadn't this year, but we're going to intend to run it next year. The Development Association have a weekend in June. The musicals, or the Cultus, had the county flag here twice, and they had run programs here during the autumn, spring time for musicians. There was 96 young musicians learning to play music here. So,
and how important are they? Is it to keep the tradition going and to keep the?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's important for the people of Swanlambar, and that's what's kept us going throughout all the problems of the troubles and deterioration of the business and everything like that. The local community has still kept faith with each other and the football club. While we wouldn't have great numbers at times, we're still kicking above our station. We're intermediate. We got to senior one time and we were put back down. But there's teams who are bigger towns than us at junior level. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's times where we'd be struggling to keep a team going, but we always will do, and hopefully we'll continue to do so.
Okay, and it's all about community, is it? And
community, that, yeah. And bringing people together, yeah.
So as time went on during the Troubles, you had, the IRA. Now, they were a different organisation in the beginning, as you know, they
yeah, changed. They're possibly there would have been sympathy towards the cause, and they would have probably had a lot of support. Not a lot of support, but they would have had support locally. And as time went on and the Troubles went on, there may have been less support and less sympathy to their cause because they would have been diversifying into other activities. So therefore what was started off as to be to try and to help the Catholics in Northern Ireland and the civil rights movement, as that went on and on and on, I would say that, not saying they wouldn't have got less support, but there would have been possibly a wee bit of less support or in sympathy to our cause, you know what I mean? There was talk, and again, I have no evidence of that there was local safe houses, etc., etc. You know, there may have been, and there may have been people staying locally, and that would have been possibly known by some people, but like, I came across none of them or anything like that, so yeah.
What about Trouble with informers? Was that another avenue?
I'm not aware of anybody who had. Now, there was an incident where a local man was brought away and was dropped back again. But the talk at the time was that maybe it was something happened that was misinterpreted, that he was given information and it was taken in the wrong context. And when they found out that it wasn't what it was they thought it was, he was released. And a lot of people would have been very disappointed that, you know, that he was actually kidnapped or whatever happened to him at the time, and the local football club got involved in a search for him and everything like that. And he was missing for 3 or 4 days, and thank God he came back again. But I don't think it really did affect his health, that particular person at the time. And again,
he was taken off as
he was living on his own. He was living on his own up the road, and he went missing. Actually, in fact, he was a pensioner, and
what was his name?
It was P. McGovern.
Yeah,
P. Muncher was his name.
Yeah,
and he used to be down first thing in the morning to me for his pension.
He was like related to you?
No. Yeah. McGovern is a big name, but no.
Yeah.
And he was always the first customer. And at that time, you see, the phones used to open at 8 o'clock, and I used to open the phones at 8 o'clock, and I'd be manning the phones, and you'd have a few phone calls around 8:10 when local businesses to start to move.
Yeah.
And then I wouldn't open, I'd open the shop, but I wouldn't open the post office until 9. I wouldn't be supposed to open the post office until 9, but I would open it because it wasn't computerised then, and nobody'd know you were doing business like they would now or anything like that. So P had come in and he'd get his groceries for the week and get his pension first of all, get his groceries for the week, and maybe pay for the groceries that was there for last week. That was the done thing at the time by people. And anyway, this Friday morning he didn't appear, and as the day went on I got worried. So myself and a cousin of mine, after 5:30, we went up to the house where he lived, and we went in and shouted, and we knew him well, like, you know what I mean, and he was missing. So we walked around the fields, and as the evening went on, we realised there must be something wrong. That maybe he got a heart attack or something like that. So we contacted the local Garda station, and we started a search. And so there was a search for 3 or 4 days, and that was Friday evening. And on the following Monday or Tuesday morning, the local creamery man, the man who was bringing the milk to the creamery, met him at the Black Rocks.
Where's the Black Rocks?
The Black Rocks is about 3.5 miles out towards Llangefelyn. And he was standing there when Joe Gillini, who was at the creamery.
And what did he say happened to him?
He didn't know. He was disorientated. And Joe brought him into Daddy. And Daddy, Mammy and Daddy got tea for him. And then the guards came along and brought him away, and he was brought to hospital. And poor P, I don't think P knew exactly what happened to him. You know what I mean? So, obviously.
But he was, in fact, kidnapped.
It was some speculation that seemingly the IRA thought that he informed the local guards about something or other, and that he was brought by the guards to the RUC barracks. This was all speculation. Again, this is all hearsay and local people. And that he was seen at the RUC barracks in Inniskillen.
Yeah.
And this is why he was brought away. But again, there's no evidence, and
did that affect his health afterwards?
Oh, it did, yeah. He deteriorated big time after that.
He
was a gentle soul. He was happy-go-lucky. He lived from day to day, got his pension on Friday, got his groceries for the week, had his few drinks, and lived then until next Friday. And he lived in his own house up in Moneydew, and he did no harm to nobody. And it was, you know, good old fun, and that was.
But these are the casualties.
That was one of the casualties of the situation. Unfortunately, he died, I think, of cancer after. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it could have been brought on by the trauma of whatever happened to him. You know. So.
When it came to, we were talking about the roads being closed off, and. I think you did something about that. Yeah, you opened up another road.
I didn't personally. No, I was younger at the time, but it was great fun because there was, in the beginning, used to come busloads of us on the down to open the road.
Where were they coming from?
They were coming from Dublin, they were coming from all over. There would have been possibly Republican sympathisers and people who had genuine, felt aggrieved that they were closing the roads, and the local people were supportive of it as well, because the local farmers couldn't go about their daily routine, and these people came down and support them, and they came down and the roads had been blown up and big concrete bollards put across and steel girders in them. And what happened then, they'd come down maybe 200 or 300 people on a Sunday afternoon, and they'd have picks and sledgehammers and diggers and whatever else. The diggers came later, but in the beginning it was more manual, and whatever was there, they'd break it up and fill it into the river or into the hole and make a road across that was passable for a vehicle to go across. And then that was fine, and that was 3 or 4 roads were open the first weekend, and then maybe within a week the British Army came along and blew them again, and the following week they were opened again, and that went on for maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And then it got once or twice now it became where the army were waiting on the people to come, and they fired rubber bullets and plastic bullets, and for young lads going down, we used to be looking for the bullets, you know, to gather to see could we get them. And no, it was there. If our parents knew we were down there, yeah, you know, it wouldn't be a place to be, because they were, you know, thinking that maybe you get hit accidentally and be in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it was a great adventure for younger people. And then it wasn't an adventure for the people, the farmers. They wanted and were serious about getting them open, and their livelihood was being affected by it, you know what I mean?
Course.
So,
yeah.
But unfortunately, the roads remained closed. The more people opened them, the more they were closed. Yeah. And then eventually the local people who were involved in it continued, got a digger. And there's a digger down there now left as a monument to the time.
This is a kind of a reminder,
what was happening. It's a yellow JCB, you know, and it's there, a caterpillar, and it's on stones at the border. You can see that down at Farley's, Gortorl. Farley's had a house there, and unfortunately for the poor Farley's, they were just on the border, and when all these explosions were going off, sure, their house was wrecked, you know what I mean, and they got very little compensation for it. In fact, going back to the time the bombs were on the Swad, at the time people were not insurance savvy, or they weren't compensation, they weren't mad about compensation, and people didn't get paid. The houses in the main street, you know, probably got paid for the ceiling or something like that, but the foundations were obviously damaged, the roofs were obviously damaged, and people didn't get rightly compensated.
So there was no kind of backup at all to,
no.
To what had happened.
Like, it was Swanland Bar, even throughout the years, has never really been compensated by the state for all the bombs. Thank God there was nobody killed, and which was great, but maybe if we had somebody killed, we would have been compensated more and got better looked after by the state years afterwards. But like, Swanlinbar was forgot about.
Yeah,
you know what? It's the most bombed town in the south of Ireland, I reckon. When you count,
but
the
it was extraordinary with all the bombs, and no casualties.
No, except Noel McGinn that time was the one casualty. Like, the night the church was bombed, like, that was, thank God there was nobody in the church, because the church would have been open when usually a load of local people would pray after benediction and so on and so forth. It was about 8 o'clock, I think, that night. Eamon Coughlin was running a race on television, I was watching it, and I was in the settee stretched out, and I was blown out of the settee. I remember that night, a friend of mine, John Joe McGovern was actually in with my mother in the shop, and John Joe had walked across the bridge minutes before the bomb went off. And when we went out the next day, we got one of the brass handles of the door of the church in the, at the entrance across the road from our house. You know, and it was a big, heavy brass handle.
Imagine that.
He could have been killed by that going across the bridge. Well, maybe it went up further, I don't know, but that's what, you know, thank God there was nobody walking across the bridge at the time the bomb went off.
Yeah, The fact that your town was wrecked, I mean...
There's different sections of it wrecked. The bomb in the church, the wrecking, was over a 100-pound bomb, you know what I mean, which was a big bomb. The rest of the bombs would have been maybe 20, 30 pounds. Remember, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There wouldn't have been sort of 500-pound bombs, so it was the area in which the bomb was placed mostly. So when you think about it, the bottom of the town, the middle of the town, the middle of the town, the other end of the town, and Furnaceland. So every area of the town had a bomb. So every area of the town, the houses in every area of the town were victims of an explosion, and nobody really got any compensation. Maybe for a wind that's broken or an odd ceiling that fell down, but for the houses, in my humble opinion, would have been basically all damaged.
Yeah,
and were never compensated for that.
It's an extraordinary story. I mean, you think of your just, you know, you could walk across to the border.
Well, you can, yeah. The water, yeah. The border's only...
Did you always see that as a different country, a different place, a different different people, maybe?
Yeah, possibly. Well, because the border was there, and it was County Fermanagh, well, which from a GAA point of view, they were Fermanagh, we were Cavan, and we wanted that end of it from a GAA point of view, first of all. And then when the troubles started, obviously, you didn't get to know your neighbour. You know, when the border roads were open, you got to know them and you had an affinity with them. But then suddenly when the border closed, you were never going up and down. I remember when the border was open, the local butcher Jack, when I was a Gosson, I used to go with Jack Keenan, and we used to deliver meat out of the back of his van Friday, Saturday. Yeah. And we do cannoli and Enniskillen on Friday evening. Was it Friday evening? I think it was, yeah. And we do Llangefnlinne on Saturday. But all them roads were there for Jack, in and out, and you get to know all the people. And as a young fella, I got to know all them people. But as an adult, they were gone from me.
As soon as the curtain came down, that was it.
You know what I mean? And I remember going around with Jack one day before the roads were closed, and one time we were coming up, not the Gartora Road, the other road, I can't think of his name, not the Stumpy Road, but the road out anyway at Glasdrummond, and down in the valley.
And this would be a quite country road.
And it was in Northern Ireland. We were coming back up towards Swad, and in the valley on our left hand side, there was about 20 soldiers each side walking up in a group. And we were looking down at them. Now, that was a wee bit scary as me as a young fella in the van with Jack. Jack didn't pass much remarks.
Yeah.
You know, whether he did or he didn't let me think he did, you know. But they were marching up to the border. And that was the time, start of the, when the roads were going to be closed, maybe a few weeks after that. And that was one of the last times that Jack was able to go around and do the runs, kind of up and down them roads. Now, he did go around again for a few years after that, when there was only one road, but he had to go down that road, drive back up to Swanland Bar, and look across at it at the border, and drive back down again.
So the name of that road again is...
It was at Glasdrummond. It was, Caldera, down that direction.
All right, and when you looked down into the valley, you could see the soldiers.
20 soldiers each side, you know.
Each side.
They were walking in a field, and each side of the field, the soldiers were walking towards the border, and we could see them walking towards
the border. And that was the beginning of it.
Well, it was on at the time, but it was really, for me, it was the time that they were really up at the border, and they were going to close the roads and close down some things.
Oh, listen, it's an amazing story, and Gregory McGovern, thank you very much indeed for telling me your story.
No problem.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Maurice.